So welcome to lecture 10, February 17th. I think I have the date right for a change. Lecture notes page is 87, I believe. I'm recording. I assume whoever is going to present from Delta Chi is not here. Delta Chi, not Chi. Chi, you say Chi, Chi. All right. Well, hey, that's the Brotherhood of a Lifetime. They've got 99 chapters worldwide, nationwide, with 125 active members nationwide. They have a LinkedIn site just for Delta Chi. Is anybody here at Delta Chi? 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 Nothing. Okay. And you can have an alumni mentor for your if you're an undergraduate student. They do philanthropy. For example, the Jimmy, well, suppose that's V or 5. Anyone know? Jimmy V, OK Foundation for Cancer Research. Delta Chi has raised $2 million in the last 15 years. And the Kent State chapter alone has raised $7,500 since 2018, and they will be hosting a car smash towards the end of the semester. Who would like to smash a car? Three people? You guys don't have enough aggression yet. Wait till after the midterm. You'll be smashing cars. And you have the opportunity for brotherhood. And I don't know, do they do sisterhood too? Maybe they're only guys. And if you have any recruitment questions, contact any of those people, and that'll be in the housekeeping slides. Same number of students since last time. Still need face coverings. Next week, we're still talking about the sales and marketing fair in person and virtual. Extra credit number 2 closes tonight. Mini test 5 and extra credit number 3 open tomorrow on the regular schedule. No change there. Midterm grades. This was in the syllabus we mentioned the first day of class. I haven't mentioned it since. Will be based on the first 5 mini tests plus the results of the midterm 1 exam plus any earned extra credit you have. That's worth approximately 36% of your final course grade, and it's required for me to do for this course. All 10,000 and 20,000 level courses have to report midterm grades. The midterm closes on Wednesday, March 2nd. This is due on the 7th. That gives me time to get it all posted. Questions on the idea of midterm grades being posted? Enhanced learning extra credit. We know that 2 will close tonight, 3 will open tomorrow, regular schedule. We know that mini test 5, well, there's the results from mini test 4. Average score 88%, number of students taking it 97%. I still can't figure out what those other 3% of the people are. Number 5 opens tomorrow at 8 a.m. So midterm exam coming up on the schedule that you've seen. It's in the syllabus and the lecture notes, posted on the website, and now I'm telling it to you here as well. It opens next Wednesday, the 23rd, at 8 a.m. You will use Proctorio, which you're partially used to now because you've been using it for the mini test. This Proctorio will record your video and your audio, and it helps me to be sure of academic integrity. You're not getting help from somebody else. You're not looking stuff up online. You're actually working from your open book and open notes, right? That's the point of this. So you know about it. I'm telling you about it. Web students, wake up. Wake up. Here. Put it in your planner. Don't tell me you didn't know about it. Midterm 1 is worth 70% of your course grade. It includes all material from Lecture 1 through today, Lecture 10, both the lecture and the textbook material. It's what's covered in mini tests 1 through 5, which is why I open it after 5 closes. Midterm is 50 questions, multiple choice, and it's time. Regular time students, standard time students get 80 minutes. No, that's not enough time to look up every question on the test. You aren't supposed to look up every question. You're supposed to have studied some of it, get those answers, and then go back and use the open book, open notes to look up stuff that you didn't know. It's like a real course with a real test. Questions are randomly drawn from the same pool of questions used for the mini test, but for the midterms and final, I focus on content, course content, not on business in the news or marketing news. So those questions are not on the midterms, not on the final. Some students mishear what I just said. Some students think that the 5 attempts they randomly had at the mini test were the entire pool, and that's the only questions that could possibly show up on the midterms and the final. And then they say, he said that it would be the same pool of questions. I never saw anyone that I took. That's because the pool's massive. You get 5 attempts, but you only see the ones that are drawn in your 5 attempts. You want to see more of those questions that could be on the midterm or the final? Use the review tests. The review tests come from the full pool of questions, and if you actually work those and study them, you could actually see the test questions. That's also why you can't bring those to the test. That would be cheating. But you can study them. Yeah? Randomly drawn. Midterm is open book, open notes, physical copies, right? Paper copies. You can't get electronic copies. If you're an international student who has problems understanding the speak or reading the written word, I guess would be the point, you can use a standard hard copy translation dictionary. You can't be poking around with something digital because I don't know what you're doing. Standard hard copy dictionary. You cannot use any digital stuff during the test. Don't come back later and say, I was talking to my mom because she was having a problem. Talk to mom after the test. I'm sorry. Don't be on digital during the test. Yeah? That'd be cheating. Midterm is proctored using Proctorio, camera, mic, screen. I may not have put up a Proctorio sample midterm yet. I will do that. Do I actually have it record you? I'm trying to remember if it needed to do that so it records you as well. I'll look into that. But before you take the test, do a fresh reboot of your computer. Start fresh. Don't have any other programs running, and you're more likely to have a good experience. You need to have a picture ID. KSU ID is good. Passport is good. Something with a picture on it that I can identify that you're you. You do not need a code or a password for any of the tests, the mini tests, the midterms, or the final exam. I don't care what it says to you. You don't need it. But if it does ask you for it, you can read about what to do in the Proctorio help module on campus. See where it says Proctorio troubleshooting, or it's asking me for a code. My first idea is always reboot your computer, clean start, have no other programs running. My second idea is some people have had success with the Microsoft Edge browser instead of Chrome. And my third thing is read more ideas in the help document. Okay, but you don't need a code. Don't need a code. No code. Open book, open notes, have hard copies of your textbook and lecture notes. Really, it's got a lot of material, which you've noticed. We covered quickly, which you've noticed. Have the book, have the notes with you. How many people don't have the book? How many people don't have the notes? Okay, your grade, not mine. You cannot use any electronic devices during the exam other than the computer connected to the exam. That one you could use. You cannot access any other online sites during the exam. You cannot have notes from other sources, you know, downloaded from the web at the exam. The point is, this is your handiwork, your work. You've been taking notes, using the lecture notes, taking your personal notes, fine. If you typed out your lecture notes or, you know, done them up in the cloud, you need to print them out because you can't access them electronically. You can't have mini test questions and or answers with you. Cheating. It's an individual effort. You can't ask your roommate, your friend. There's no phone a friend. You can't collaborate with anyone else on the test. Somebody actually told me one time, I didn't know it was, you know, an individual effort. I didn't know I couldn't ask anybody. You might want to make use of the 2022 spring review test to help study for the midterm. Really, you might. So how do I study in general? View the lectures and complete the lecture notes, or write out your own notes, whatever you prefer. Go back over those notes. Highlight the information in some way that makes sense for you. Maybe use yellow for terms and definitions, greens for examples, pink for, I don't know, whatever you would do. Or use post-it notes to mark the key material for easy reference. Read the textbook. Go back over the textbook and highlight that information in a way that makes sense to you. Then the tricky part that some students didn't learn in high school and still haven't got, study the material. All right, study the material. Too many students forget to do that because it's open book, open notes. Why do I have to study? Because it's a lot of material. You can't memorize it all or look it up all. Use the review test to see what you know and what you don't know, and then go back and study what you don't know. Because the midterms are drawn from the same pool of questions of the review test, you may actually see some of the questions that could be on your test. That's not cheating. Take the review test until you know them well and do well on them. Going back to study what you do not get right, bring your books, bring your notes to the exam. Don't bring many test questions or answers. That would be cheating. Take the midterm, and by then it ought to be pretty easy if you actually put in the work. Somebody's going to get a 20, and I'm going to shake my head because I don't understand that. Somebody's going to get 100 or at least 98. That's doable. Makes me feel good. Questions on the midterm, please. Yes, sir. Is it curved? So, yes. My philosophy of curving is as follows. You may choose to disagree, but you aren't going to change my mind. In a large class of 600 people at the 20,000 level, so it's not in your major, it might be for your major, it's not in your major, what would we imagine the average might be? Would we imagine it would be 90%? That doesn't seem plausible. 600, many of these people don't care about marketing, business. Some don't care about school. So no, 90 would, 80% still seems a little high. 70% might be marginally low. 60, 50, 40, that's not right, okay? So what might it be? I say I will curve the entire class to, usually, 72. Now, if everybody, if the grades were actually higher than 72, I wouldn't down curve them, right? That would be nutty. Although you could make a case for it, that would be nutty. And if the top person gets over 100%, they get over 100% with the curve. So typically the curve might be 4 to 6 points. I've seen it as low as 2. I don't think I've ever seen it higher than 6 points added to your score. So it's curved in that sense. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Other questions? Yes, sir. Will the what?
Will the sample be worth extra credit?
Nope, nope. The only extra credit is the defined extra credit, which is the enhanced learning extra credits or the pack back or a research study. Nothing else is extra credit. Doesn't count for you, doesn't count against you to do the sample test. What else I got? Questions? We're good? On the midterm. Super. So on to marketing of the news. Gatorade. Who likes Gatorade? People? Some. Oh, big Gatorade's a thing here. Debuting its first big marketing push under its new Chief Marketing Officer, Kalen Thornton. Gatorade is using this weekend's NBA Star Game. Where is that being held? NBA Star Game? All-Star Game? Where? Cleveland, Ohio. Oh, thank you. Cleveland, Ohio is to debut a new campaign that pushes its Fuel Tomorrow initiative, which aims to lower barriers in sports by providing money and resources to community organizations. Yay, Gatorade. So we see sports events marketing, right? They're getting the buzz from the sports event portion, and they're doing some social responsibility. Good job, Gatorade. It marks the first big marketing push for the PepsiCo-owned brand under Kalen Thornton, a former NFL player. How many people know Kalen? How many knows that name? Not one person. Okay, sports buff. Former NFL player who joined Gatorade as his chief marketing officer last year after a long career at Nike. A new ad, which will air for the first time on Friday, tomorrow, during the All-Star Weekend's Rising Star Challenge, is called Fuel Tomorrow. It features voiceovers from WNBA's Candace Parker, NBA player Damian Lillard, as well as rising young basketball player Isabella, I don't know how to say that, Escribano. This is the moment it all starts, the players say at the end, but only if we get the chance to have it. So here's the use of celebrities in marketing to get attention and make the point.
There's a moment. Blink, you'll miss it. But in that second, the game changes everything. That first swing, step, look. The moment we ask, what if?
What if we could go further, jump higher, or run the whole thing? What if we could be who we're meant to be? It can happen.
It can happen.
It could happen. If we're given the chance to play and become who we look up to, that's when we find our stride. And tomorrow belongs to us. This is the moment it all starts.
This is the moment it all starts.
This is the moment it all starts.
But only if we get the chance to have it.
Fuel Tomorrow, Gatorade is committed to helping millions to play. Campaign is part of a long-term strategy, an evolution of Gatorade, and a move to reinvigorate the brand. This marks the first time Gatorade is putting money and resources behind its values. The brand plans to give $10 million to community organizations such as Athlete Alley, Ally, which ends to aim homophobia and transphobia in sports, and Honest Game Foundation, which preps students to meet NCAA requirements over the course of 5 years. So building their brand image, I mean, they're doing socially responsible things, which is good, but also helps their brand image among the target audience, right? With a focus on reaching young people, the initiative focuses on the idea that sport has the power to change lives. Challenges to sport accessibility include lack of resources and money, as well as where people are physically located. Noting the difference in infrastructure and sports fields between, say, New York City and Texas. For instance, the Lone Star State has a lot more open spaces suitable for sports field than does Manhattan. The campaign, which is rolled out during Black History Month, in this way also includes pushing for diversity and against stereotypes and microaggressions. He noted that his first sport was gymnastics, an unorthodox sport for someone who looks like me. So a bit of authenticity. The campaign also aims to leverage the attention around the NBA All-Star Game, as will air on multiple channels, including TV, streaming, and digital. Young people, particularly Gen Z and also Gen Alpha, are the campaign's focus, so our target audience and our media strategy for this new Gatorade campaign. Thank you. This was an interesting survey that came to my attention about the idea of social shopping, shopping off of those social media sites. Retailers that do not engage in social commerce may want to jumpstart their efforts to get involved. So here's the importance of social media to marketing. According to a new survey of U.S. consumers who are active on social media from cloud-based social media management software provider Sprout Social, close to 7 in 10, about 68% of respondents, have already purchased directly from social media. Nearly all, 98%, of the respondents plan to make at least one purchase through social shopping or influencer commerce this year. So a bit of marketing research and a bit of thinking about the consumer's purchase intention, one of those things we talked about in their decision-making process. What do they plan to do? Examining social conference commerce preferences by generation, the survey found that Gen Z shoppers, 18 to 24, anticipating using visual-first social networks like Instagram, TikTok, and Snapchat to make purchases in 2020. How many of you have made a purchase in, say, the last year off of either Instagram, TikTok, or Snapchat? Maybe approaching 70%. All right. Web students, you too. All right. While Gen X, 41 to 56, and baby boomers, 57 to 75, plan to increase their purchases on Pinterest and Facebook. So here we're understanding the consumer, and we're seeing the segmentation of those age cohorts we talked about before, those demographic factors in terms of how their behavior differs. Yeah? Additional findings from the survey and key trends related to social commerce. More than 85% of respondents who are currently using virtual reality and augmented reality have already started social shopping. How many of you guys use virtual reality? One person? Two? Three? Four? Okay. I think I talked about my wife being a Beat Saber beast. Yeah. It's too much. Too much for me. It gives me short of breath. And I've already started social shopping. 60% of respondents report that they're more likely to buy from brands that highlight inclusivity in their content. For instance, featuring different races, ethnicities, or gender identities in ads and feeds. Inclusivity is especially important to younger shoppers. 73% of Gen Z and 72% of millennials cite this as a purchase factor. So is diversity and inclusion important in marketing? Yeah. It's for its own sake, for society, but also because your consumers want it, another reason. So understanding consumers' evaluative criteria. Recommendations from friends rank high in impact across all age groups, serving as the primary source of influence for consumers ages 18 to 40, even ahead of influencers. This is true for baby boomers who still trust friends and family the most. So we're seeing the influence of socio-cultural items. I don't know if you can picture this from the notes that we talked about before, but here are these social cultural items coming down to the influence of reference group, family, friends, etc., on the consumer's behavior. So stuff we're talking about theoretically, you know, the little models, it's real world stuff. It applies. A recent survey from Accenture supports these findings, indicating that the 492 billion global social commerce industry is expected to grow three times as fast as traditional e-commerce to 1.2 trillion by 2025 from 492 billion in 2021. The social commerce share of e-commerce spend will grow to 70% from 10% over that time frame. Our survey findings make it clear the opportunity, strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats, we talked about that, has never been greater for brands to leverage the social storefront to create powerful, frictionless connections with consumers. As the majority of consumers have already made a purchase on social media or plan to do so this year, brands that embrace social commerce as a key part of their omnichannel, there's that phrase again, omnichannel strategy, will more effectively pique the interest of consumers, help drive revenue, and outpace the competition in 2022 and beyond. So social shopping and brand strategy. So it's where it's at. Finally, that obviously drew from our thinking about the B2C model, business to consumer model, right? Consumer behavior. Now we begin to look forward, which we'll get to today, to thinking about organizations as customers IBM is B2B. In this case, they aren't thinking so much B2C for this. IBM charts new brand direction with campaign built around creativity. IBM is charting a new course for its brand in what the tech company says is its most significant campaign in more than a decade. So we're seeing business and marketing strategy come to fruition, B2B marketing, business-to-business marketing. The company has rolled out a new global campaign themed around the tagline, "Let's Create," narrated by Donald Glover. A simple 30-second spot shows a blank page and a cursor followed by text illustrating some of IBM's core business goals. The campaign will also encompass digital, paid social, out of home, and other channels. So we're seeing global marketing, business to business marketing, and media strategy. Here is the ad for the new campaign.
Every big idea, every game changer, every how they do that starts here, the blank page. Artists and writers know the tyranny of it well, but so do developers, data scientists, CTOs, the new creators. To them, we say, let's create something that changes everything. IBM, let's create.
There we go. Let's create from IBM, a teaser ad for their new philosophy. I'm not sure if I want security to trust no one. I would like it to trust me. IBM says it's the first chapter in a new effort to redefine its brand following spinoff of its managed infrastructure business into a new company called Kyndryl late last year. The goal of this initial stage is to sharpen perception of IBM's new purpose around business integrity and help companies evolve their technology. The next phase will focus on real-world examples of IBM clients, and the third will revolve around new creators using technology. So, whew, that's the marketing campaign plan. We're recreating our brand image. It really puts a spotlight on creativity and how important that is in developing solutions and answers to the challenges facing our clients. B2B, help those business customers with their problems. It's not a rebrand. I look at it more as a reintroduction of the IBM today. So we're building B2B brand image, providing value to B2B customers. IBM has historically had trouble articulating a clear and unifying purpose for a business as sprawling and multifaceted as a 110-year-old enterprise has become. But with business moves like the Kyndryl spinoff, helping to strengthen the company's core focus on growth areas like artificial intelligence and hybrid cloud computing, IBM decided it was time to boil down its public-facing message. So remember when we talked about product portfolio management, the strategic business units, where they were growing, how they fit, how strong we were, what you wanted to divest yourself of, dogs for you? This is sort of that example. They're applying it to their company and paring it down to their core business. It wasn't a good fit for them. So we try to make it really, really simple for people to understand, because if I'm going to be candid, we haven't always been simple and clear in telling the world what we do, why we do it, and who we do it for. So here's their communication strategy. All right, so we're going to pick up with lecture notes, page 87, which is 148 in the textbook, finish chapter 5, Understanding Consumer Behavior, and then we'll begin, maybe finish, I don't know, chapter 6, Understanding Organizations as Customers, as Consumers. So last time we ended up, and I should have been smarter than to tell you it was right before the end of class, with this little piece demonstrating or trying to demonstrate cultural differences. And my point there was, as you saw a little bit of Hugh Laurie, who was played the doctor on House, if any of you remember that show. He's British. He's joking with Ellen DeGeneres about words, English words, that they don't understand. So as you go to a foreign culture, right, it's going to influence people too. Do they like beef? Don't they like beef? What's the gender roles? How important is family? There's a well-known book that's in it's called Kiss, Bow, or Shake Hands. So when you interface interculturally, what's the appropriate thing? Do you kiss someone? Do you bow to them? Do you shake their hands? All right? Cultural differences. But it goes on to make the point that it's not just these physical interactions when you meet someone from a foreign culture in business. It extends, of course, to your websites. What's the appropriate symbolism? What's the appropriate words? What's the appropriate images that you use in a foreign culture? We'll talk about global later on. So culture, subculture, social class, reference group, family are all these sociocultural influence on the consumer.
Now.
Yeah. All right, other influences on consumers' purchase decisions. We have situational influences. For example, what is the particular task that you're doing? Why are you shopping? when you buy a wedding gift, something for a special event like that, do you buy the same thing that you would buy for yourself, typically? You buy something special, right? China or silver or that expensive blender that you always wanted, but you're going to give to them instead. So what is the task that your consumer's engaged in when they go to buy your product? What are the social surroundings? Remember, we already talked about the idea of social influence, and just one other person can influence how people feel. What are the social surroundings when the people go to buy your product? What's your store retail display look like? The physical surroundings, I don't know if you can quite see that, but on the right-hand side is a very expensive men's haberdashery in Los Angeles named Bijan. Anybody know Bijan Haberdashery Men's Store for any reason, Bijan? I have several pictures of me outside his store in Beverly Hills, because in order to get in to shop, you need an appointment and a lot more money than I have. Very, very neat, sophisticated. Left-hand side, you can see perhaps, is a junked-up place, clothes all over the place. You ever been there? There's stuff on the floor. There's stuff all over. Yeah. So what are the physical surroundings in which people are shopping? How does it make them feel? What about the time effects? Are you rushed to buy something? In which case, you're not doing a lot of in-store shopping. You're just grabbing something, maybe a package that looks familiar. Sometimes that's why we grab the CVS package instead of the national brand. It was the wrong one, but I'll try it. So are people rushed when they go to buy your product? What about existing, pre-existing states as they come to buy your product? Are they depressed, which right now is practically a national mood in the pandemic, but okay. Are they hungry? When should you never go grocery shopping? When you're hungry, everything looks good, right? You want some of the, you want extra packs of the kumquat flavored ding dongs along with Gatorade and Fritos and crackers and et cetera, right? So what is the likely physical state that your consumers are in? What does Amazon say about the importance of understanding the consumer? Neil Lindsay, the marketing senior VP at Amazon, says, Amazon is not frugal when it comes to investing in data and science to try to understand our customers, understand how they're thinking about us, but most importantly, to identify where there might be products or services that they could benefit from. That helps us to prioritize what stories we should tell and what new projects we need to raise the consumer awareness for. Consumers don't buy things they're not aware of. So the importance of understanding the consumer. Lindsay concedes that as more data floods in, measurement becomes increasingly difficult. While measurement can sometimes be imperfect, if marketers are intellectually honest and objective, you really can find both what's working and what's not in your marketing strategy. So marketing research is important, even though sometimes it's hard to do. He concluded, and that obviously then informs our rules for how to do the next thing better. But I think it takes a lot of discipline. It's really important for us not to fall in love with our own work in a way that we can't see how it could be better. And the right data can help deliver that. Understanding of the consumer and what needs, wants, and desires they have and how we can provide value to them. So, understanding what influences consumers to buy or not to buy your product and whether they will be satisfied is extremely important, yeah? It's also, as I think you've begun to see, extremely complex. So that is why we spent, 3 days thinking in broad terms about the influence is on the consumer. All right, if you're interested in this, you can learn more. There's the download of Understanding the Path to Purchase, which will be in the housekeeping slides, and I think you can download it. And if you find the course, the detail interesting, you can take Marketing 35035, Consumer Behavior. All right, so that's the end of thinking in the B2C world. Let's turn our attention to the other side of the house, which is the B2B world, organizations as consumers. Lecture notes page 89, if I have it right. And so back to our overall strategic model. We're still assessing market opportunities for us. We just got done talking about the B2C world. Now we're looking at the B2B world, which of course will then drive our marketing strategies down the chart. So let's think a little bit about what we mean when we talk about organizational markets or business markets. Business marketing, B2B marketing, involves the marketing of goods and services to, well, companies, organizations, not-for-profit organizations, And what are those companies, organizations going to do with it? They're going to use it in the creation of goods and services that they can produce and market to others. So the key difference between selling B2C and B2B, a key difference, is that you presumably buy to satisfy your own needs, wants, and desires. You don't buy products, usually, to make a profit on them. That's not what you do. So when you buy that nice coat, when you buy the nice coat, you're not trying to make a profit on the purchase. This is why B2B, why businesses buy. That's their intent. It's going to help them directly or indirectly to make money or to not-for-profit satisfy their client base better. What does it include? Well, business markets include the people and organizations that buy goods and services in order to make other goods and services. For example, well, manufacturing is a B2B market that resell that product to others. So wholesalers, distributors are in the B2B market that conduct the organization's operations. So they are buying things to help them do better at what they do. Machine oil, lubricants, copiers, staplers, toilet paper in the bathroom at the industrial level, helping them to do their business better. In the past, we used to call business markets industrial markets. Yeah. Sure. There. We good? So we used to call them industrial markets, but of course that was in the old days before services were such a big part of what we do too. So they're now referred to as business markets, although someone may still say an industrial market. So what are the main components of this business market area? Agriculture. Anybody grew up on a farm? Sometimes you get one, just one person. Well, thank you and your family for their helping America to live better. So what's the challenge in general in the agriculture community to increase the efficiency of agriculture? To get more precision agriculture to have better crops, yeah? Resellers are a second component of the business market. They sell products in essentially the same form that they get them. They're not changing the form much, but they do create a variety of utilities for other businesses, including time utility. Manufacturer makes them a while ago. The wholesaler holds them for a while till you need them as a business. Place utility, they make sure they get to where you want them when you want them. Information utility, about what's coming down the pipeline, what's happening in the market. Possession utility, helping you to finance, perhaps getting this product into your inventory. Part of the problem, of course, right now with supply chain is this is having problems. Services are part of the B2B community. So whether we're talking about H&R Block for businesses or our friends over at Felber and Felber Marketing, they're a service. So financial institutions, ad agencies, trucking firms, warehouses, tax services, and so on and so forth are part of the business market, helping those organizations to do what they do more successfully. Government is a huge component of the business market. Government makes up about 35% of the gross domestic product. That's big. So you're buying a submarine, it's a big expenditure. On the other hand, 35% is government. About 60-some percent is the consumer, B2C. You guys are about 60-some, 66%. Which is why you can't just spend yourself at the government level out of recession. You're big, but you're not big enough to affect the entire economy, just as government. Consumers have to get on board with what you're doing. Government is unique in terms of how you do business with them. They have a competitive business system. There's lots of bureaucratic obstacles that sometimes makes it hard to work with them. International trade. International trade is a 1.5-ish, because it changes depending on the pandemic month we're in, trillion export business opportunity. The government has lots of programs to help you engage in international trade. Let's see, total trade, January to December of 2020, Looks like 1.4 trillion in exports, 2.3 trillion in imports, so 3.8 trillion in total trade opportunities. If you're a business person, there's room for you to grow there. Right, so we see the impact of COVID-19, 1.6 trillion in 2018, 1.6 trillion in 2019, 1.4 trillion in 2020. Don't have the update for 21 yet. All right, so just as a matter of interest, who do we do a lot of trade with? Well, number one, China. As of 2020, still probably true in 2021. Mexico, Canada, Japan, Germany. So there's lots of business opportunities in a B2B world. Let's see what, is this the current update? Year to date, what year are we in? Okay, so there we are, still in 2021. All right, so in 2021, oh, look at that. Total trade, Canada, Mexico, China, Japan. Oh, interesting, I'll have to update those slides. So I do have an update for 2021. Looks like in 2021, Canada, Mexico, China, Japan, Germany, top five. Cool. So there is an update out there, I just didn't update yet. All right, non-business or not-for-profit organizations, charities, not-for-profit. These firms do everything that a for-profit company does, except keep the profit they make. If they don't make a profit, they go out of business, right? So they do require professional management, professional marketing, et cetera, to be successful. All right, so let's hear a little bit about Timken's view. They are a B2B marketer steel and bearings.
Yeah, a lot of people are surprised about the growth prospects for us. In fact, would say looking back 20 years, business has never been better. The industries that we've focused upon, and part of this goes back to industries are willing to pay for the value we create, and not all industries see the differentiation we can provide. But the ones that do, and they tend to be heavy industries, and I'll name a few, you know, the steel industry, power generation, cement production, aggregate, many other heavy, wind energy is a new one for us that is growing leaps and bounds, and those are the kinds of energies we've targeted because those industries, we feel we can deliver value to the customers in those industries, and it just so happens those industries are all going great guns right now around the world. I think as anyone understands who picks up a newspaper these days, anything that's dug out of the ground is red hot right now. Iron ore, coal, you name it. I mean, the energy industry, oil exploration, another key industry for us. So it's actually pretty surprising that most of the industries we serve right now are very strong. We see strong demand continuing. And, you know, one of the weak industries is the automotive industry in North America, which has been a stronghold of the Timken Company for a long time, a key industry. And it's one that we've really taken a hard look at, and we've said that, you know, again, for those customers who are willing to pay for the value we create, great. If they're not, it might be an industry we gradually diminish our focus on.
So there's an interesting comment. In the B2B world, we provide high-quality tapered roller bearings for companies that see the value we bring to them, and we can provide bearings and huge, you know, wind turbines that turn and turn and turn, and you don't want those things to break. They're, you know, they'd be a pain to replace, etc. You could put a tapered roller bearing in a car that would last 75 years. Wouldn't be that expensive. Do car companies want bearings in their wheels to last 75 years, 50 years, 20? They don't really want that. It's not worth it to them to pay for a top quality bearing. They'd like you to change your car out every, I don't know what their philosophy is, 5, 7, 10 years. They're not going to pay top dollar for bearings. A wind turbine, you do not want to fail. You're going to pay top dollar there. So you hardly ever go out and buy a tapered roller bearing for your self-consumption, but these B2B business, these businesses do and value what Timken has to offer. So this is a rough estimate when I put it together of the type and number of organizational establishments in the U.S. We see that they're categorized by something called the NACIS sector. We'll mention more about that in just a minute. So here is the various kind of markets. We see agriculture, mining, utilities, construction, manufacturing, transportation, and warehousing, information, finance, services, not-for-profit organizations, reseller markets, we talked about, wholesaler and retailer, the government market. And where's Temkin? Well, probably more than where I'm just going to say, but they're in mining, oil, and gas. They're in construction. They're in transportation and warehousing. So, and government. Those might be the key sectors in the B2B market that Temkin would operate out of, for example. Yeah? And others they don't. As we think about this B2B world, we note that there's a lot of international trade in it. We have to deal with the folks in Canada. We have to deal with the folks in Mexico. There's a lot of trade going on there and a lot of products going on. How do we think about it? How do we categorize it? Well, they've come up with a couple of categorization schemes. The North American Industry Classification System, NACIS, and the North American Product Classification System, NAPICS. And the point is to help us across, well, within our own country, but across countries think about how to talk about these different codes. Let's try bearings. No. And so what are some categories that pull up with bearings? Well, mechanical power transmission equipment, ball and roller bearing manufacturer, motor vehicle, gasoline engine and engine parts, industrial suppliers, merchant wholesalers, motor vehicle, etc. And so we begin to see categories in which we might learn more about what's going on in the world of, in this case, bearings. And it goes on and on and on. A company in Kent a long time ago manufactured rubber tubing. I forget the company. But they started getting inquiries from folks doing medical work. And they said, that's odd. We don't actually sell for medical use. But apparently some wholesaler, some distributor was selling the tubing as medical. They began looking up medical tubing and found a whole new industry that they could provide value for with the right tubing and the right marketing. So you never know what you're going to find depending on those opportunities out there. So these coding systems help us to talk about industries, but also help us to look for opportunities that might be out there. So what are some characteristics of organizational buying? In general, B2B companies, business-to-business companies, have important differences compared to B2C companies. B2B companies typically sell complex products and services at the heart of what they do. They sell these through a often complex and systematic purchasing process. This process often involves multiple stakeholders at their client customers, and the sale can often take a long time, and in really expensive situations can take years or decades to complete. That would not work well if I want a candy bar. I don't want to wait that long for it. Demand within the B2B world is not directly from your customer, from your client. Rather, it's downstream from your client's client. This is the idea of derived demand. The demand for industrial products and services is driven by or derived from demand for consumer products and services. So if you are a manufacturer of lithium batteries and glass screens and microchips, you manufacture those things and you're selling it to people who work with it, what product might this go into making? What would it be? Cell phones, smartphones, right? So if I'm manufacturing glass screens and you are buying glass screens, you don't buy them just to have them, to have a collection of them as a business. You buy them to put into smartphones that are going to sell. So your demand for my product isn't based on your needs per se. It's based on the needs downstream of the consumer, which means in many cases business-to-business marketers have to understand that ultimate market downstream, even though that's not directly who they're selling to. So business-to-business marketers have to understand the final consumer in many cases, because it's that demand that's going to drive their customer demand for the product that they're creating. And in fact, in some cases, B2B marketers have to encourage or want to encourage the sale of their customers' products downstream. So we have B2B marketers marketing products that they don't directly sell to encourage you to buy cell phones so that they can sell more microchips, batteries, and glass screens. Not an obvious sort of thing, perhaps. So we have to be attuned downstream in the business-to-business market. For example, what's Intel create?
Processors.
Unless you're really a computer geek, when's the last time you went out and bought a computer processor? Never. That's why I phrased it that way, because I suspected you might be a guy who went out and bought a computer processor. How many people have gone out and bought a processor themselves? That's one. You can talk to him. That's two. That's it. All right? So nobody else goes out. So that's not what's going on. We don't really buy processors per se. But Intel wants you, the consumer, to know about them and even to prefer computers that have Intel inside, right? So in the 1990s, Intel Corporation launched a global marketing program to make people care about the microprocessor in their computer. Marketing directly to the end user was a novel idea for a semiconductor company. Although the company was widely recognized among B2B computer manufacturers, in the 90s, Intel did not have much name recognition among end users. They just didn't care. It was a PC. What do I care what's in it? The task of branding the chip in a PC became known as Intel Inside, the world's biggest co-op advertising program, reaching over $1.5 billion in ad spending. Here is a computer chip ad that has very little to do with business and a lot to do with consumers.
For years, Intel technicians have been making PCs smarter. Now they face their greatest challenge ever.
Hey, no one messes with my brain until I get sprinkles. Suckers.
Now anyone can have all the brain power they want. Just look for a PC with an Intel processor inside.
By eliminating covalence inhibitors, we create triple-dense carbohydrates and thus the so-called super donut. Many of you mock my interest in the pastry sciences.
What do you have inside?
No! Bong, 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 bong is their little, you know, the little tag notes there. And what are they doing there? They're trying to get the consumer, through a pretty amusing ad, to care about what's inside. The multi-million dollar campaign is the largest for Intel since Multiply, the September 2006 campaign that supported the then new Intel Core 2 Duo chip. It's called Sponsors of Tomorrow. That was expected to have a lifespan of 3 to 5 years, but it ran until 2013. Again, talking a little bit to B2B, but mostly to consumers. Here's the idea to consumers of your rock stars. And here's our rock stars. They're a little bit different than these guys.
We are Intel, sponsors of tomorrow.
So again, they're having a little bit of fun with the community and their rock stars versus your rock stars. And more recently, they're talking about the consumer experience. We're in the age of experience. We have to tell people about all the amazing things that Intel has been a part of. When we were working with the ad agency, I was like, did you know we were in the space shuttle and the Hubble Space Telescope and Stephen Hawking's computer? Intel's been a part of these huge cultural experiences, and we as a company have never talked about them or tried to get credit for them. But we have to let people know, kids today don't care about what's inside, they care about what they get to do with it, their experience. That's been the impetus for this recent campaign. experience what's inside. They've still kept the bong, 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 bong as their tag note. So they're trying to get the ultimate consumer to think about this. When we think about this realm, we certainly have to think about something called the elasticity of demand. You recall your micro-econ course. Inelastic demand, that happens when the total demand for all of the products in the industry responds very little to changes in price. So regardless of whether price goes up or down, there's little or no change in the demand overall in the industry. So price does not affect how much is sold. Inelastic demand. This occurs when the cost of this thing that you're selling is a small percentage of the finished product. So really, lowering the price of the rivets in your building doesn't make you want to build more buildings. It's just not that expensive. Or in your 787 Airjet, teeny cost of the overall thing. It's not going to cause you to make you want more of those products. Also, inelastic demand occurs when there are no close substitutes. So the price goes up, you still need whatever the thing is. You can't just go do something else. So you still have to buy it. In the mid-1990s, the price of white bond paper went up 150%. Businesses in the 1990s, computers weren't really a big thing yet, used a large amount of white bond paper for massive catalogs, home catalogs, brochures, displays, etc. In the short run, the demand for white bond paper didn't drop much. But in the long run, businesses said, wait a minute, this is too expensive. What could we possibly do to reduce the impact of white bond paper on our business? That is one thing that helped computers grow among businesses in the 90s. This switch in the long run from white bond paper, for which was no substitute, over to computers. Demand is more elastic when a price change occurs within a single firm. So overall, I'm not going to buy more rivets, but your company drops the price. Maybe I'll buy more from you. So the demand curve for a single firm might be quite elastic, even though it's not elastic over the entire industry. It also can be more elastic when we view it from a long-term perspective. So fashion students, fashion. So you've made your plan, you've laid out your designs, you're planning for the next season, you've got the cloth in mind that you want to use, you're pretty well ramped up and locked in, right? So now the price of the cloth that you're planning to use for your next season suddenly goes up. For what? Supply chain problems. What are you going to do right now? You really are stuck right now to use what you plan for. It's really hard to change right now, right? What are you going to do next season, though? Are you going to use that same thing that went wildly expensive? You're going to change, right? So in the long term, we find that demand is more elastic. That price goes up. Short term, I may have to live with it. Long term, I'm getting out of it. So higher price, new material next time may affect our demand. Also, it's more elastic when the product is a significant cost of the finished good. So if oil, which has gone up to almost $100 a barrel, coming up on that, if that's an expensive part of your product, it may indeed cause you to want less of whatever it is you're making. All right. Also, compared to B2C markets, we have a difference in terms of the size of the order, how much money is being spent, and the number of potential buyers. There's something like 6 million employer establishments. Those are establishments that have paid workers. And there are something like almost 26 million non-employer establishments, or overall about 32 million firms. And I forget what I'm looking at here. What am I looking at here? Just the quote in terms of the number of firms. So that's true for the firms. About how many consumers are there in how many consumers are there, ultimate consumers are there in the U.S.? Well, what's about the population of the U.S.-ish? 330 million, all right? So you see quite a difference in terms of how many entities you have to reach in a B2C situation versus a B2B situation. So here's our about 330 million ultimate consumers. Here's our population clock, which is always a little fun to look at. This is hypothetically a real-time look at what's going on in the US and in the world. 10 most populous countries, if that's what we were looking at. China, 1.4 billion. India, 1.36 billion. US, 331 million. Indonesia, Pakistan, Nigeria, Brazil, Bangladesh, Russia, and Mexico. Here's what's going on in the US population. So we've got about 332 million in the US, and on February 16th, it was 332 million. So there's quite a difference here in terms of the number of entities you have to deal with in marketing. Relatively small in numbers compared to the B2C market, but big dollars spent, big purchasing power, lots of money being spent. So it's very expensive to buy a submarine. It's very expensive to buy an offshore oil rig. It's expensive to buy a big industry refrigeration unit. These things are expensive. And they're concentrated. For example, Goodyear, where's Goodyear headquartered? Thank you, Akron, Ohio. Goodyear in Akron, Ohio's fate depends on selling tires, OEM, original manufacturer equipment, to a handful of auto companies. And the big three auto companies buy a lot of tires. And where are they located? Headquartered. Big three? Headquartered? Detroit?
Yes.
Detroit, okay. So they're concentrated. So your future, your demand depends in a large part on these companies, and they're concentrated in one area. So there's a fewer number of them. Big purchases concentrated in areas has implications for how you market to them. This is just showing the regional concentration of manufacturing. So when you look out here towards Arizona and New Mexico, not a lot of orange. When you look here in the Great Lakes states and through the South, a lot more manufacturing going on. So it depends what you're selling, but these entities are a lot more concentrated. Also, again, they aren't buying for their own personal pleasure. Businesses buy from other businesses to help them achieve their objectives, such as reduced costs. If you can go into a company and show them that your product or service does what they already have, as well as, or even better than what they already have, at a reduced cost, are you going to get their attention? You bet. Reduced cost, increased profitability, you have my attention, tell me more. Increased revenues. Whatever it is you're going to sell them will cause more people to buy whatever it is they're selling. Interesting. Tell me more. Or if the point is that this company wants to be socially responsible and you can help them do that, boom, you got their attention. So these are a little different objectives than we have with the ultimate consumer. Now, just like you, they have to make the decision on what to buy. So they're going to apply, like you do, a variety of evaluative criteria. How are we going to make up our mind among these various choices out here? One factor is certainly price. We just mentioned cost, so that's an issue. Also, though, and we've seen the impact of this, every time I say supply chain problems, you got to think delivery issues. But in general, in a non-pandemic era, how well can you meet my schedule? Because I'd like to have your product here just when I need it. Past performance, how well have you as a vendor done in the past? Your production facilities and capacity, I'm planning to grow. I'm going to go into Europe. I'm going to grow by 30% in the next 2 years. Can you supply me? Can you grow with me or not? Warranty and claim policies. I never followed up to see how much Takata and their airbag problems that cost the companies a lot. But I don't know, did they pay out in warranties and claims? But that brings that topic to mind. Technical capability, can you produce products to my specs over the long run? Can you get more complex as I get more complex? These might be evaluative criteria that we want to think about for those vendors as we try to sort out who's the best potential supply chain partner for us. So what are the evaluative criteria? How important are they are to your customer? How are you doing in terms of meeting those and advertising them? Quality specifications. How many of you guys have heard from management probably of ISO 9000 or something like that? Couple. Okay, this is really a big deal if your industry, B2B industry, needs a particular specification quality met. So ISO 9000, one of a variety of standards, are standards for registration and certification of a manufacturer's quality management and assurance system based on an on-site audit of the practices and procedures developed by the International Standards Organization. And here you see this particular company, TransTech, has its team out there proudly indicating that they're both ISO 9000 and AS9100 certified. An indicator to your potential customers that you can meet their standards that they need. So why is this all so important in B2B buying? Well, firms have to have the right product at the right time, at the right cost. And I can pause right there and beat the drum one more time. And what happens when they don't? We find ourselves in the world we're in today with supply chain problems and companies not having the right product at the right time, at the right cost. And it's disruptive for everybody, right? More or less, depending on what time you're looking at. But in this difficult world we find in, it hasn't worked out. Let's go back in time and forward in time. Companies in general are making less themselves and buying more from suppliers. For example, Toyota spends something like $25 billion a year on purchasing, not making, parts and supplies. So they need to be there. Otherwise, they don't work. Firms can't tolerate defective parts or supplies because they're not stocking up on them. When it comes in, they need it to work. So we have things like just-in-time manufacturing. You get in those supplies you need, those pieces, those parts, those assemblies, just in time to manufacture whatever you need. You don't want to sit them in a warehouse. Just-in-sequence within the production line. They get there just in the sequence you need them in. So firms need to work with fewer suppliers and develop long-term relationships with them so that, at least in normal times, you can have these things. Now, right now, as of course you know, management, companies, businesses are rethinking this supply chain issue a little bit. Should we have relied so heavily on things with long supply chain? Maybe we should be making more at home, more ourselves. We'll see what the long-term impact there is. But in general, we think about working together with our partners to develop new products, to share information on inventories, on production and costs. But the supply chain problems caused by COVID pandemic does have businesses rethinking this concept. I'm not smart enough to say what we'll look like in 5 years. Check back, we'll see. So we need to have good relationships in our supply chain. So we talk about the buyer-seller relationships. We talk about our supply partners. Supplier development is a deliberate effort by organizational buyers to build relationships that shape suppliers' products, services, and capabilities to fit the buyer's needs and those of its customers. I go off script for a minute, and I debate about whether or not to bring this topic in. In the consumer world, of course, a massive, massively influential company is Walmart. Walmart buys a lot of product from a lot of companies throughout the world. So in that sense, they're working in a B2B world. Somebody sells product to them as a distributor. They're a business, and then they sell to us as a retailer, right? So Walmart has had some interesting success with RFI tags. Anybody know what an RFI tag is? RFI tag, what sort of?
I've heard of it.
Okay. So RFI tags are these things that can go in products, and for one example of it is, you know, when you take it outside the store and it beeps? That's not exactly right, but it's that sort of thing. But better yet, these things, who's been to Topgolf? Okay, what happens in Topgolf? If you haven't been there, it's gamification of golf. You go out and you get a golf ball, you tap it or whatever to activate that ball, and you smack it along with, I don't know, 100 other balls going out there. It knows your ball, where your ball went, what your score is. How's it do that? RFI tags. Yeah, these tags inside each ball. The tags are down to the price that they're about 4 cents a tag. So it's gamification of golf. It's fun. In business, it can help you track inventory, know where your inventory is. Have you ever gone to a store that said they had 10 left of something and they don't have any left because they couldn't keep track of their inventory? So Walmart's had some success in using RFI chips in various products to track inventory, etc. They're now going to expand it to a whole bunch of other products. So up this stream, a whole bunch, they don't have to ask nicely. They can just say, do it. A whole bunch of their suppliers are suddenly going to use more RFI chips in their products. And by the way, if you're supplying a bunch of load to Walmart, you might as well just put it in everything else that you're manufacturing. It's just easier to do it that way. So in the near future, we may see a lot more inventory control, tracking of products, et cetera, from these RFI chips. So supplier development, that they're developing their suppliers to fit your buyer's needs and those of their customers. Just in time, just in sequence, we just talked about. Maytag, as a supplier of consumer goods, wants to make sure that all these pieces and parts work well. Maytag repairman, if you ever saw the old ads, they don't ever want to have any service. They want to sit around. They want your machines to work perfectly. That means all their pieces and parts have to work perfectly. So their suppliers actually have their reps in the Maytag plants watching over things and making sure if there are any issues or problems, they're going to fix them, right? So this is the idea of supply partnerships. As I said, the buying process for many industrial products is complex. I alluded to this idea when we talked about the family as a decision-making unit. We said there's a bunch of roles, a bunch of people, conflicting needs, wants, and desires, conflict and compromise. In the B2B world, this happens quite often in something called the buying center. This is a group of people in an organization who participate in the buying process and who share common goals, risks, and knowledge that are important to the purchase decision. As a marketer, you have to know who these people are. They cut across all areas. So you might have folks from manufacturing, folks from finance, folks from operations, folks from IT. You as the marketer have to A, know who these people are, B, know what they're looking for, and C, sell to them. So who are they? You have to know it. What are their individual backgrounds and experiences? You have to know that. What agendas do they have in IT that might be different than the agenda they have in manufacturing? And how is that going to relate to the product you're selling? How are you going to market to that? Just as we talked about these for the family, we have gatekeepers, influencers, users, buyers, and deciders. Many times in an industrial setting, the gatekeeper can be the front desk receptionist at the corporation or the company or the manufacturing plant. So smart marketers, smart salespeople, make sure they always have a good relationship with that front desk person. Otherwise, you've irritated them, you've irked them, you've not treated them right. Oh yeah, Dr. Marks, I'll take your card. He's busy right now. I'll make sure he gets back to you. And you can't get through the gatekeeper. But the gatekeeper could be IT. The gatekeeper could be someone in manufacturing. Influencers, you have to know who these are. You have to understand them. There was an example of a marketer that had pretty well sold the buying center, had pretty well talked to the CEO, had pretty well expected the sale to go through, and it didn't. Sold to somebody else. So the salesperson goes back and talks to the CEO and says, in essence, what happened? And the CEO said, you know, your product looked pretty good, but my wife didn't like you. What? In this case, the influencer outside the organization caused the sale to be lost. Who are the influencers? How are you going to find out who they are? Suss them out and make sure you're working with them. The users can be the people in any area of the organization. The buyer in the IT or in the B2B world, that's the person who has the responsibility for negotiating the contract. But in low-level purchases like toilet paper and pencils, they may simply make the purchase. It's not that complicated. And the deciders. Who are the deciders within the organization? You certainly have to know that. What type of buying situation does your potential customer find themselves in? In some cases, the one I just alluded to, you have a straight rebuy. Toilet paper, pencils, machine oil. This is not an elaborate process. The company probably has a list of preferred vendors, people they've worked with before that are able to supply a good product on time, right quality, right price, and the purchasing agent just makes the purchase. Actually, as a marketer, that can be pretty hard to get into. There's nothing new. What are you going to do to get their attention? They're happy with who they already have. Or are you selling in a situation of a modified rebuy? There's an interesting new player with some new characteristics or attributes. The models have changed or something like that. In my domain, when a new textbook rolls out, it's not earth-shaking, but it's something new to look at. Should I consider the new textbook or not? What do I think about it? So that's a place where you might have some consultation going on, some people involved, some discussion. And then you have the idea of a new buy. In the case of a new buy, we don't know who the players are. We don't know what the key characteristics are. We don't know how things work. We don't know anything. My example here is the first time you're buying a robot manufacturing line. What do you know about that? How about a robotic teacher? That could be good. So what are you going to look for there? That's the whole Megillah. That's the whole thing. You have to have a full-blown court press, and the marketer has to know how does their clients, their consumers, view these things. So straight rebuy, usually one person involved, the buying agent, decision time is short, get some pencils, problem definition, I got that. Buying objective, typically the low-priced supplier that delivers on time and the right quality. Suppliers usually considered my current list, and the buying influence is usually the purchasing agent. In a modified rebuy, you might have two or three people involved. I might look at that new book. I might walk it around to a couple people in the department. I might say, hey, what do you think about this? Decision time is moderate. Problem definition, well, minor modifications might be possible. Buying objective often would be the low price supplier. We consider the present, and I would add any new players that have this modification. And the buying influence would be the purchase agent and a few others as appropriate. And then in a new buy situation, buying a robotic manufacturing line, lots of people are involved. You can take a long time to make up your mind. We don't know what the problem is. We don't fully understand it. Our buying objective is not the low-price solution. We want a good supplier, a good solution. Suppliers, new and present suppliers, and the buying influence are the technical people as well as the operating personnel. So I saw a movement among the audience, so I noticed that it's now 2 minutes short. So this will be the end of the material for mini test 5, which then makes it the end of the material for midterm 1. Okay? So keep in mind things close tonight, the extra credit, open tomorrow, mini test 5. Have a good day, have a good weekend, stay dry, see you later.